This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 97 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. I was watching the Vikings-Saints game this past weekend, and I heard Troy Aikman say, after a bad deep ball thrown by Drew Brees, that Brees has struggled with his deep ball in 2017. Meanwhile, on throws that traveled 15 or more air yards this year, no player had a higher completion percentage in all of football than Drew Brees. So I tweeted about it. I said, I love that Aikman's talking about Drew Brees' lack of deep ball ability this season when he had the highest completion percentage on deep throws in the NFL. And then I got the best response imaginable. It said, Aikman equals 3 Super Bowls and 2 eyes. You equals 2 eyes, a calculator, and a couple of fantasy championships. Winner is ... the guy in the Hall of Fame. Amazing. What an amazing response. This is precisely the issue I continue to have with sports, and specifically football. Because a player had success playing the game, they can do no wrong. Or, as another example, because a coach got to the position that he's in, analysts who don't play the game, like myself, can't critique what the coach is doing. Because the coach knows more than we do, according to these people. Here's the thing, I totally agree that a coach knows more about football than I do. About game planning, about play calling, and about leading a group of large men on a football field. I cannot do that, and he knows how to do that. But this overall mindset that fans have is really unfortunate. Sean Payton made some terrible challenge choices in that contest against Minnesota, but since he's a head coach and made it to that level, we shouldn't criticize his choices? The Falcons cut off half of the end zone with their fourth down play call at the end of their game against the Eagles, but we shouldn't question why they made the call that they made? And then there was the Steelers. And that brings me to the first question of this week's mailbag show. This question's from at Bethany L. Peters. You've mentioned before that you think that coaches don't usually go for two as early as they should when they know that it's inevitable. What are your thoughts on the Steelers' early onside kick against the Jaguars? It was an awful decision among many awful decisions that were made throughout that game. Analytically, you should not have kicked the onside kick there. But beyond that, you have horrible fourth down calls from the Steelers, you have that early onside kick, you have the lack of timeout before the 2-minute warning, and then you have the Steelers opting to continuously try to score a touchdown at the end of that game despite the fact that they needed 2 scores. In those scenarios, most of the time, coaches should be kicking the field goal early on and then hoping for an onside kick recovery to at least give your team a chance to have a heave into the end zone to win the game. Instead, the Steelers scored with almost no time left, and they had to squib the ball down the field and they couldn't do an onside kick. This was probably the worst coached game that I've seen all season long when you factor in the importance of the game and the personnel that the Steelers have on that team. To sit back and not ask why or to not realize that coaches don't have all the answers is ridiculous if you're passionate about the game. If you don't care, you don't care. That's fine. But let's stop this garbage that we can't have opinions because we're not coaches. We all should be able to have opinions, especially if those opinions are based on research and facts. And this is exactly why bad teams stay bad. They have no idea how to innovate, or they're pushed away from innovation because the NFL has this massive old-school mentality blanketing the league. And it's sad. If you watched Mike Tomlin's post-game presser, he said he knew that the analytically smart choice was to not kick the onside kick, and he still did it. The culture in the NFL has to change. It just has to change. This next one is from @DominateFF on Twitter. Who do you see as next year's bounce back player and why? So I've talked about this player before, but I'm just going to reiterate it because of the coaching change that happened this week, and it's Marcus Mariota. And I think, by extension, you could talk about the entire offense. Tennessee was the only team with more rushing touchdowns than passing touchdowns this year. Yes, they were a fairly run-heavy team, but those kind of numbers even out in the long run. And as a result of that too, Marcus Mariota had a 2.9% touchdown rate after finishing 2015 and 2016 with a 5.1% rate and a 5.8% rate. Those two were above average rates, and this year's was far below average. Now add on to the fact that they'll have a new coaching staff, and things really should turn around for Marcus Mariota next year. This next one is an email. It says, don't you think that streaming tight end is getting much more difficult, higher variance, than quarterback and defense? Since the wide receiver pool is so wide, is it a good idea for me to draft a tight end higher in 2018 than my wide receiver 2 so I could have a more reliable player at the tight end position? Congratulations on all the good advice, Giovanni. I'm going to think a little bit more abstractly with this answer because I'd rather get everyone's brain going rather than give you a strict numbers-driven take on the subject. Because with something like this, it's more theory-driven anyway. First, we need to remove labels when we're drafting. You mentioned drafting a tight end over a wide receiver too, but thinking about your team in this way can get you into trouble because it can force you to roster fill when you're drafting. What I mean by this is when you draft, of course you're looking at players as he's my RB1 or he's my wide receiver 3. I mostly mean that you're doing yourself a disservice if you think of your wide receiver 2 as only your wide receiver 2. Players flop and don't finish where you thought that they'd finish all the time. The guy you draft as your wide receiver 2 might end up being your wide receiver 1, and your wide receiver 1 might finish as your wide receiver 4. So you really shouldn't lock in some strategy and say that you should take a tight end before your second wide receiver, especially right now when we don't know which wide receivers will be drafted where. It's January. We've got months before we have to actually make these decisions. Your point about tight ends, though, is one that's talked about all the time throughout the fantasy football industry. The piece that I think that most people fail to think about, though, when they get excited about taking the tight end position early in their fantasy draft is opportunity cost. It's the same issue with quarterbacks. Yes, of course those players are better than the rest of their position. And with tight ends specifically, you've got a good opportunity to gain a nice edge over your opponents within the position by taking one early. But by taking one, you're missing out on the opportunity to have an early round running back or wide receiver. And not only could you hit on that player that you'd be foregoing, but that player also increases your odds of hitting at wide out and running back the more in-demand positions. Meanwhile, since there's only one tight end being started per team in your league, you can always get late round ones who are viable. Now, the other piece to this is streaming. You mentioned that it's higher variance, which is completely 100% correct. Of the four big positions in fantasy football, tight end has the most variance week in and week out. But that variance also exists for all tight ends, to be fair. Because tight end was such a dumpster fire this year too, streaming actually ended up not being as tough. You didn't really have to do a lot with your tight end streamer for him to be viable. With my other podcast, Living the Stream, we streamed a tight end 5, and that's without having the luxury of saying, we streamed Evan Ingram early on and just held on to him all season long. We had to make tough choices towards the end of the year when we had more information on players. The good tight ends were already owned, and we still had a tight end 5 via streaming. So all of this combined makes me say, of all the onesie positions, tight end is absolutely the one that you would hypothetically want to draft early. That's always been my stance. I was even on Team Gronk at times this past offseason because his ADP was pretty reasonable. So I don't think that your take here is necessarily wrong. I just wanted to run through all the abstract thinking stuff because when the time comes and you're evaluating players and their ADPs next year, I want you to think about some of the outside-the-box stuff that I just outlined. Because in fantasy football, not everything is simply about how many points a player scores versus the rest of his position. Opportunity cost and game theory components are very, very important. This next one's from Twitter, @thefellowJGM. Is completion percentage becoming a joke of a stat for quarterbacks due to the increase in short passing plays? Completion percentage has technically always been a joke of a stat for quarterbacks because it fails to put context around the throws. Like, imagine that you own your own pizza place. Maybe someone listening to this podcast does own their own pizza place, and if you do, please send me free pizza. But imagine managing two pizza delivery drivers. At the end of the night, one driver delivers 10 pizzas, while the other delivers 15 in the same amount of time. You look at the numbers and you say, well, the one person who delivered 15 must have been the better driver that night. But that's not necessarily the case. What if that pizza delivery person traveled just 10 miles, while the other one traveled 30? Technically, then the driver who delivered 10 pizzas is more effective than the one who delivered 15. This is the same deal with completion percentage, you guys. When you throw the ball deeper, you're going to see a lower completion percentage. So I don't really think that anything has changed to make the stat any more or less of a joke. It's always been this way. We just haven't always thought of it this way. It's worthwhile to look at, I guess, but you need the context of average depth of target to make completion percentage a truly worthwhile statistic. This next one is from Jason. He says, why are 10-team leagues so dissatisfying? Of the 5 leagues that I'm in, 1 14-team league, 3 12-team leagues, and 1 10-team league, I usually lose interest in the 10-team league quickest and have never done very well in it. What's most interesting about this to me is that the owners of that league, the 10-team one, are some of the worst that I've ever seen, yet I have never won that league. What is it about 10-team leagues that makes me lose interest? Have you noticed this as well? I mean, I tend to favor larger leagues only because to me it favors owners who are building stronger benches and working the waiver wire well. But you're asking the wrong guy about losing interest in a fantasy football league, if I'm being honest. Fantasy football is one of my favorite things on this planet. I don't lose interest in fantasy football. With that being said, I can see how people grow annoyed by the lack of creativity at times in 10-team leagues. That's why I try to push for larger starting rosters in those types of leagues. You might have tougher start-sit choices in shallower leagues because teams are better, but I'd rather reward owners for smart drafts and team management overall, not just guys who make good start-sit choices. So that's perhaps why you lose interest. You're probably on my side when it comes to all of that. But I also think that you probably are losing interest because that league is just bad. A good commissioner can always, always, always make a league fun, no matter the format and the size. This next one says, where does the Jags defense rank from an adjusted metrics perspective? I got in a discussion today about who was better, the 2013 Seahawks defense or the 2017 Jags D. Thanks again for all your work, and I look forward to more off-season podcasts. Mike. Looking at the NumberFire database this year, the Jaguars defense had a schedule-adjusted defensive net expected points total of minus 94.2. That number is negative because the defense is preventing points, not adding to the total. So essentially, the Jags prevented 94 more points than they should have this year on defense. However, the average isn't zero because it's easier to move the ball on offense these days. The average this season was actually 36.52, meaning the Jags were about 130 points better than the average defense when adjusted for strength of opponent. In 2013, the Seahawks had a minus 98.49 adjusted defensive net expected points total, so roughly 4 points better than the Jags this year. The average that year was around 32 points though, so we're looking at a near dead even difference between the Seahawks defense and the average defense and the Jags defense and the average defense for their respective years. With all that being said, from a regular season standpoint, I may give the edge to Jacksonville, and the main reason I say that is because offensive efficiency was just generally better in 2017 than it was in 2013. And Seattle's offense was better than Jacksonville's. The Seahawks started each drive on defense with better field position than the Jags did as a result. But Seattle ended up dominating in the Super Bowl and in the playoffs, so it's really hard for me to say that Jacksonville's defense is better than the Seahawks' defense. So I'm going to go with Seattle, but remember, we're talking about two really, really freaking good units. This last question is one that I liked a lot. It's from @dbro_ffb. Who is 2018's breakout player at each position? So I took this as a fantasy football question, so I looked at quarterback, running back, wide receiver, and tight end. And obviously, this can and will change as the offseason moves forward and we're introduced to more information, players in new situations, rookies, yada, yada, yada. But I figured that it would be a fun exercise to run through. At quarterback, I'm going to go with Mitch Trubisky. And no, it's not because of recency bias and me thinking that he's going to have this Jared Goff-like turnaround with a new coaching staff. Because Trubisky was better during his rookie year than Jared Goff was. Goff's turnaround was historically good, the best that we've ever seen from one year to the next. I mean, look, Trubisky really needs help at wide receiver to really be able to make this leap. But even with literally nothing as pass catchers this year, Trubisky ranked ahead of 8 200-plus attempt passers in adjusted net yards per attempt. That's not great by any means, but given the context of his situation, that's also not terrible. They have a new offensive-minded head coach in Matt Nagy, and he seems to be surrounding himself with the right coaching staff thus far. And look, quarterback is kind of a tough position to call for breakouts because there aren't a ton of choices each year, but Trubisky is the clear one for me in 2018. At running back, I'm going to go with my dude Aaron Jones. People who have listened to this show from the start last April know that I'm a big Aaron Jones fan. He had crazy college production, and when he got his shot with the Packers this year, he certainly did not disappoint. When charting rushing net expected points versus success rates, so we're looking at efficiency versus consistency with each run, Jones was one of the better running backs in the entire NFL this year. That's not necessarily predicting the future by any means, but Jones should have some opportunity next year in a split backfield, but he's a great pass catcher, so he should have opportunity as a receiver as well. And then you add in the fact that he's in an Aaron Rodgers-led offense, and you've got yourself a lot of potential for a breakout in 2018. And then at wide receiver, I've got to go with Corey Davis. Just as Aaron Jones ranked well within my prospect model, Corey Davis was the model's top player this past year, at wide receiver, that is. He had a little touchdown misfortune during the regular season, he was hobbled throughout the year, and he really just didn't produce like we all thought that he would have this season. But this goes back to the Mariota thing too. An increase in touchdown rate, a new coaching staff, and just better general health should make a great prospect into a legitimate breakout candidate in 2018. Now, with tight end, I think the obvious go-to might be OJ Howard. He came on strong towards the end of the season. He showed flashes throughout the season. But I'm going to throw a little curveball here. I'm going to go with Trey Burton. Burton's a free agent after the season's over, and I think that a lot of fantasy owners saw his potential this year anytime Zach Ertz was sidelined. Burton was tight end 1 in week 14 against the Rams when Ertz was hurt, and then he was tight end 7 in week 9 under similar circumstances. people saw that he's a good pass catching tight end. And it's taken some time to get there because Burton was recruited in college as a quarterback. He ended up playing running back, wide receiver, fullback, and tight end at Florida. The dude is a beast. If he lands in the right spot this offseason, he could be a legitimate breakout candidate in fantasy football. But that's going to be it for today's show. Thank you all for listening. If you've yet to subscribe to this show, please do so by going to Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Google Play, and Stitcher. And like I said earlier in the week, if you're on iTunes, do me a favor and leave a rating and review. And please, if you have mailbag questions, hit me up on Twitter at LateRoundQB or email me at jj@numberfire.com. Thanks, everyone. I'm going to be away and at the FSTA conference next week, so unfortunately, you won't hear my voice again until Friday for another mailbag episode. But until then, enjoy the games this weekend. Take care.